This is an interview with Robert Winter, which we're having in the oral history office. The date is January 5th, 1987. I'm Laura Smale, doing the interview for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives Oral History Project. And I'm going to ask you to begin with, Mr. Winter, to say something about your background.
I started in 1950 as an accountant.
I mean, really, where you come from, when you were born?
Oh, I was born in 1924 in the Appleton area. I went into military service. Following that, I attended the University of Wisconsin, first the Extension Center in Menasha. Mm-hmm. And I transferred down here and I graduated then in 1950 with a Bachelor of Business Administration in the School of Commerce, I believe it was called at that time. Immediately I started working in, which was then the Board of Regents of Normal Schools under Eugene R. McPhee. I was, within 2 or 3 months of my starting, I put the biennial budget together for the system, which was then quite small in dollars, as well as enrollment and so forth. And I continued in that role as became assistant director, but always with the major emphasis in finance through 1971, when up until merger in 72, when I became vice president of general services. I was responsible at that time for the capital budget and a lot of the procurement, the personnel, fringe benefits, and so forth.
Now, I'd like to have you say more about your period under McPhee, something about him and how he ran the state university system.
He really started as a one-man operation prior to mine, but not too long. I think he's only in the position for about 2 years. He was what I would say a very skillful higher educational administrator as well as a skilled politician, political educator, with a lot of, I guess, good common sense in knowing how to relate to the education of people on one side and the political people on the other. He had a quite a comprehensive experience in relating to government during his war years when he was a military governor through the in the country of Italy and took over and operated in the place of the mayors and so forth. So he developed a lot of good techniques and knew how to relate to people. He also had the ability to appear and relate to politicians very effectively. I can best typify it by watching him perform before the Joint Finance Committee. Before he would start talking, they would say, well, now we're going to handle the state colleges or state universities, whichever it was, period of time there. And immediately the legislators all around would have a smile on their face. He had the ability to answer questions and spontaneously come forth with jokes, which would just befit so perfectly in the response to a question. He was very well liked and respected. He was tough. He was a colonel in the service, but he was also tough. He was Irish and Scotch, and had that Irish humor. And in Scotch, he was kind of tight personally with his finances. But his big thing is he had quite an experience in relating to political side, because he started out as a high school principal and then Packard, I believe it was an elementary school superintendency, and then he moved into the superintendency end of it, and knew how to relate to the local government. Then he moved into teacher education administration, where you had continually working with the school districts and so forth. So he had a lot of personal savvy, plus he just had the ability to know how to get along with top executives. So he just fit right in with them. The governors all liked him. I can't recall a governor that he could not relate to very effectively. He always managed to be available, and he knew how to use his position most effectively in getting financial support. He knew what to say and what to do.
He could get along with either a Republican or a Democratic governor?
It really didn't make a great deal of difference. Mm. No, I don't think he got along as well with Nelson as he did with some of the others. He started out with Kohler, who was governor from 1950 to 1956, and he developed a very effective working relationship with him. Governor Kohler had a financial person by the name of Art Wagner. I don't know if you remember that name. He was a CPA here in town, and he was Kohler's financial advisor. And that was the start of developing effective relationship. We actually moved, I believe, from the south wing of the Capitol at that time to the east wing, and we had our own stairs going up to the governor's office. Mm. They would come down.
Handy.
So he really developed, and with the budget director, they just all respected him. So if we put in a request, we had a good chance of it getting approved. At that time, E.B. Fred was president, and who was also very effective. You remember all about E.B. Fred, and they worked well together. They had a lot of respect for one another, and they worked quite effectively.
Did they compete with each other?
No. In fact, I go way back when I used to sit in with our conferences. You know, we go over and talk about strategy, and the other person in there was Fred Harvey Harrington at that time.
Yeah.
And they were quite. Understand. They weren't, I don't think you would call them competitors in the usual sense. They were co-conspirators.
Quite different, isn't it?
Well, they just, they understood the
now
process.
Now you mean Fred and McPhee or Fred Harrington
and,
also?
No, Fred and McPhee.
Uh-huh.
Harrington and I kind of sat on the side at those times.
I see.
And although Fred is kind of hard to set aside, but E.B. was he was a politician. Although those were tough days. It's the only time that I recall that when we put in a budget request, that the governor's office came down and said we didn't ask for enough.
Under Kohler?
Under Kohler.
Oh.
So part of that was the relationship. We put in a request, and they actually came in and asked us to increase it. Under Kohler. I should ask that, add that one of the instances that counted for this was when the governor asked what should happen to the system if you have a 10% reduction in your budget. The U.W. Madison at that time refused to answer that. I can remember I was only a young squirt, and McPhee was just fuming that they'd even consider it, and I went in and closed the door and I said, "Mr. McPhee, I remember when you hired me, you said you should always answer these questions. We answered it, and that's it what happened, but the Madison campus didn't, and it really got clobbered because of that."
Hmm.
they really took it out on him.
Why do you think they didn't?
Well, they didn't. I think it was the people. You see, you had some very strong people at that time, E.W. Peterson and Neil Cafferty, which were, the A.W. could get pretty tough. You remember him, don't you?
I didn't know
well,
him,
he was
I
a very strong person, but they never answered it, and they really got hurt because of that. And it was, CD was followed then by Governor Thompson, who was very supportive of higher education. He had as his financial person, Dr. Knight here from the School of Commerce. I think this is John Knight, or I can't remember, but he was his fiscal person. And Thompson was very good to both systems. We, at that time, organized the, what was then to be the major vehicle which was used to expand facilities, to organize the Wisconsin State College's State Agency Building Corporation, which built a lot of the buildings until general obligation bonding was approved. I think that was approved under Warren Knowles, if I remember correctly. I mean, under Knowles in the late 60s. Was actually, the legislation was drawn up by Knight, who was formerly was a professor here, Professor Knight, A.W. Peterson, Neil Cafferty, and myself. We organized that state, got the statutory language in place, which we then borrowed to construct a lot of the buildings which were constructed in the early 60s and so forth.
So you knew A.W. Peterson fairly
yes.
well then?
I didn't really know him that good, except that we were very small. It wasn't a big system here.
Yeah.
Either one of them weren't very big. The offices weren't very big. I didn't work as particularly close to him, with him, but I knew him. Knew Neil Cafferty perhaps a little better. Mm-hmm. But they were the financial people at that time. Is followed by Nelson, who was a little tougher to get along with. He wasn't as normally. My perception of support is that it was better under Republican governors than Democratic governors. I don't know if that's true necessarily anymore, but
It's certainly been said very often.
It has been said, yeah. I'm not the first one who has said
no.
that. And it certainly goes from Kohler to Thompson to Warren Knowles. Lee Dreyfus, in spite of what everybody says, provided an excellent salary adjustment program. And you hear Thompson saying already, you know, he's not going to hurt the university. He's going to exempt him from some of the cutbacks that apply to other state agencies.
Let's hope.
Well, I think that will take place.
So you think Nelson was trying to save money, or do you have any?
I don't know. I can't recall exactly the details anymore about Governor Nelson. But he was tough.
He made you defend your position?
Yes. It wasn't as good as under Governor Knowles, who followed Nelson as governor. There's no question about it that Governor Knowles was a higher educational supporter of UW system. Very strong supporter. The building-wise, salary-wise, enrollment-wise, it wasn't only towards the end of his in his final term, when both systems was considered too high of an enrollment of non-residents, and they substantially increased the non-resident fees, which had subsequently then the years ahead had a major impact on the enrollments. Was leading into the Lucy period. it probably affected what was then the state universities more than the University of Wisconsin, but it also was hurt by the going to full cost of particularly for undergraduates, establishing fees for non-residents. This really hurt, and it also impacted on the appropriations in the early 70s, then, which followed through into the Lucy period.
I don't understand what you mean. They raised the tuition of out-of-state students.
Yes, for the undergraduates to 100% of the cost.
And this decreased the enrollment of out-of-state students?
Yes, and it actually resulted in many cases enrollment decreases, particularly at the state universities. And adversely,
you were getting that many out-of-state students?
Yes, a lot of out-of-state students. Oh. Yes, as high as 25-30%.
I didn't realize that.
Yes, Whitewater, Flatville, particularly, were heavily enrolled with non-resident students. It's very easy, you see. It's only 50 or 60 miles, you see, to the border from those. It's mm-hmm. closer in case of Platteville. And then you go up the Minneapolis, you know, Cross is located on the border. River Falls, Stout, and Eau Claire are located there, and so is Superior. So you have there's four up there, five, six of those schools, which are right almost on the borders, and they were adversely impacted by that.
That's interesting. I've not heard that before.
But it also affected the Madison campus here, but not to the same extent. Many of their non-residents were in graduate programs, and they were supported by other means. Mm-hmm.
I would like to ask you about the chancellors of the state universities and their relations with McPhee. I understand that he kept a rather iron hand over them.
Well, that was true. But there was a considerable degree of respect for the role that they had on the campus. He did not, I would say, interfere with the internal operations of the chancellor, except if he felt that they got entirely out of line. We were fortunate in some cases that they had some really outstanding ones. You know, Leonard Haas, you've heard that name, who is really involved in top administration when I started in 1950 and stayed at that institution until early 70s when he came down and temporarily became executive vice president under Weaver. Their relationship was fine. He also had a fairly effective relationship with the faculty, which was, I don't think, normally understood. What made McPhee so effectively, he understood the political process and knew that the strengths of that system came from its institutions and its institutions' relationship with the local legislators. He was very effective in that, and he would work with faculty as well as with the chancellors. He did give some of the chancellors a fairly rough time, but some of them deserved it. Some of them weren't. Surprising.
I mean, in what way did he give them a rough time?
Well, if he thought that they were getting out of line, surprisingly, he was very instrumental in bringing Lee Dreyfus up to Stevens Point as chancellor. He felt that Stevens Point needed a very liberal chancellor, as somebody who would change things around. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the public perceived him as just riding Lee Dreyfus. Part of it was due to the antics of Lee Dreyfus. He was kind of a showman, and I can remember one instance where he came into a committee meeting and instead of standing, he sat out on the floor. McCree just said, "Dreyfus, get the hell off the floor." No, I would say that if the press was around, they would have perceived that he was crawling all over him. But he had a lot of respect for the role of the chancellor and didn't allow us in system to get too far involved in the academic side of the operation. It was tougher than heck if they got out of line financially. But I don't think that he treated them any differently than any other good higher educational administrator treated a top-notch administrator. Some deserve to be watched closer than others. Some
because they were spending more money than they should.
And they weren't in control of their institution as well. But at the same time, he respected that they were head of that institution, and he related to that chancellor. He didn't go around them. If that is some belief, I think people who related to him in state government and maybe on the Madison campus perceived that that may have occurred. But I do not, I myself have, did not see that, that he treated chancellors unfairly.
Yes, I don't think I meant that, or at least I was thinking about the whether the state universities had much governance, or faculty governance as it's understood on the Madison campus.
And well, that varied campus by campus, and that more related to the chancellor than to McPhee. As a rule, McPhee always would meet with the, and appear with what is then the Associated Wisconsin State College faculties, or then the WA, Wisconsin State University faculties. He would go up and talk to them individually, and he had, I would say, more than what is perceived, good relations, established good relationships with the key faculty leaderships. Good faculty governance came from more from the way the campuses were organized internally. Mm-hmm. Some chancellors were not as, did not work as effectively. But I don't think McPhee would attempt to necessarily change that. He would not, because he would then get involved in almost in operations of that university. I guess I would not, there was more governance in some institutions than is what is suspected, and that had to do with the type of the chancellor that was there. Leonard Haas had excellent relationships, mm-hmm. had a strong faculty. Mm-hmm. And it has to be remembered that the Eau Claire campus was the last one to be established, about 1918 or 19, and it was established with a liberal arts base rather than a teacher education base. Mm-hmm. It became a different kind of an institution. I can say it, it's for the record. you don't have to include it if you don't want to. But it, as long as I can remember, educational quality of the students in the state of Wisconsin, the first is Madison, the second is Eau Claire, and then it drops down substantially from there.
Mm. Even including Milwaukee?
Oh, Milwaukee is way down. No, I don't want you to put that in the record, but that has always been, that goes way back. Mm-hmm. And I had the schedule one time, and if I'd have brought it to you, they don't give it out, but it's amazing how that educational quality varies. And Milwaukee is, no.
I have heard that.
That is true, too.
Not substantiated, but.
Yeah, it's true. If you look at the record, one gauge they always had is when they had the honor scholarships years and years ago in the state. It would be Madison, and then Eau Claire would get more than all of the other campuses together, and the rest would keep dribbling from it. And it hasn't changed any. And it's hard to understand why it hasn't, but apparently it's in the student counselors, and the students just know this gravity, they attract better students into it's a tougher liberal arts school, more like a liberal arts school than it is a teacher education school.
There was talk for a while of possibly attaching Eau Claire to the UW system. Did you must have known about
yes.
that. How was that received?
Well, I'm sure that they opposed it. Of course, McPhee was a graduate of Eau Claire, and I would say it didn't get much support from within.
From within Eau Claire, or the WSU?
I don't think so. No. I can see why they would have been a good marriage. The type of institution that it was. I said it just had some outstanding leadership under Leonard Haas for some almost 30 years.
Well, that's interesting to hear you say that. I'd be interested to have you comment on the expansion of the UW system, the beginning with adding Milwaukee and then adding Parkside and Green Bay, or developing them.
Well, from an enrollment standpoint and from a higher education opportunity, Wisconsin had more than adequate institutions to take care of its needs. They wouldn't have needed Parkside and Green Bay added to this as a four-year campus. I think it was inevitable that UW-Milwaukee, which should be established as a broader-based institution because of its location in a very large metropolitan area. That was not a happy marriage down there with the Extension Center, and I was somewhat involved in that.
You were?
Somewhat, yes, when they merged. That was one of the mini mergers when Milwaukee got transferred to the UW-Madison, which was then the University of Wisconsin-Madison responsibility. I would say that, you're going to edit this, I assume, that I don't think they've had as effective leadership, UW-Milwaukee. When I started, Kolache was head of that institution. Surprising, when we merged as the systems in 1972, he was still chancellor. At the time that I started, if you were to rate him, we would consider him one of the weaker chancellors. Presidents, that they called them at that time. So I don't think they had outstanding leadership. And that he would not rank with an outstanding educational leader, in my estimation. Have you heard that before?
Mm-hmm. But it's always, that's the interesting thing in oral history, is to get corroboration from various people.
Yes.
I'm going to turn the tape. Can you stay a bit longer?
Just a little bit longer, yeah.
I'm just wondering if the state universities were angry when Harrington set up Parkside and Green Bay, or what was the reaction?
Oh, I don't think that they were. I think that was kind of, I suppose, Oshkosh and Stevens Point, for example, felt that they didn't need it and probably didn't do anything to help it, probably had their local legislators opposed it. Except that there were some very strong political individuals involved. I think it was Vanderperren at Green Bay and Molinaro at Parkside. I don't think either one of those institutions, however, affected the enrollment from those schools very much initially, because they really didn't have programs which would interest kids the same way. It takes a while to establish a higher educational institution and, you know, a lot of students to enroll. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering what McPhee said. Do you remember when he heard about this? Did you feel that Harrington was trying to build up a political base of support to counter the state universities?
I remember one of the, I don't know if he was a co-director, I think he was a co-director of the coordinating committee at that time with Jim Dan Hill. And he was, of course, president up at Superior for years and years. And then ultimately got involved in a need for a movement out of him as a president at that institution. The region up there was strongly opposed to him. But he then came down and became a co-director, or he was anyway with the coordinating committee as UW's state university system representative on the leadership role over there. And he kind of supported them from the basis that there were a few cities the size of Green Bay, as well as a combination Kenosha and Racine, which did not have a higher educational institution located at that site. So he supported it from that basis. I don't think he fought against it very strongly. One of the problems was that during that period, Gene McPhee had health problems. He had a heart attack. And I think that probably, he wasn't quite the fighter that he was in his earlier years. The decision was really a coordinating committee decision, and not political. It was political in part that they had less political support. Mm-hmm. The coordinating committee really came forth with the need for that expansion. And I was a party to, as well as others, because I did a lot of the enrollment projections for the then state universities. And we did prepare too optimistic of enrollment projections. Mm-hmm. Part of it was due to the non-resident impact. We could not have foreseen that the fact that somebody can come along and go to 100% cost of higher fees for 100% of the cost as the basis for establishing fees for non-residents. And that really adversely affected the enrollment projections. It seems kind of unusual, but the establishment and the opening of those universities almost corresponded with drops in enrollment.
That's very interesting, because that was one of the great setbacks, wasn't it, that they didn't get as many people in Green Bay as expected.
Yeah, and of course, Racine and Parkside would have ultimately expected to get a considerable enrollment from the Illinois side, mm-hmm. which never took place. I think that they both started out with, this is not from an educator standpoint, but an administrator standpoint of view, that they attempted to be something unusual. And they've spent most of their time since they've been established of how they've become more of a traditional type institution. They didn't really develop, I don't think, their original objective of being something different. Mm-hmm. They're becoming more traditional all the time. Yeah. I don't know, do you hear that?
Well, I knew that Green Bay had, what was it, an environmentally centered curriculum.
And it really wasn't well received. And they're talking more additional programs. Uh-huh. They're both industrial communities, and you really need business graduates and people trained in the more usual fields like business, accounting, and in those areas.
That's what they'd like to have.
Yes.
As a training. Mm-hmm. Well, what about the extension merger? What was your reaction to that?
I really wasn't heavily involved. I mean, the extension merger.
But when Harrington merged the two extensions in 1965.
I don't really, I was never, I can't speak to that.
Because I understand that the state colleges didn't like that because it put these two separate bodies together and gave them more influence in the state.
But it didn't stop the state universities from offering extension programs. That didn't stop that.
No.
So, and they were heavily involved in teacher education programs. They were not involved in many of the traditional programs that were offered on campus. I mean, like liberal arts, they didn't do a lot of that. Uh-huh. Almost totally was education related.
So that didn't cause a flap?
No, I didn't see that as a problem.
Well, that's good. You know, one does get impressions for looking at things from Madison, and it's useful to have them.
No, I didn't see any impact, any substantial impact to that whatsoever. I would say that merger, and maybe we ought to open that subject up at another session.
Well, you can make an initial comment on it.
I think the timing of the merger and the subsequent election of governors really was unfortunate. The merger was really accomplished by Knowles, not by Knowles, but the regents, which were in power at the time of merger, were all primarily appointed by Knowles. Lucy merged them, and it wasn't until almost his end of his term when they became Democrats, and then Dreyfus became governor.
That's right.
And the we'll go into some more greater depth, I think, on that. Dreyfus, the regent, inadvertently made it difficult, particularly some of the Democratic appointed regents, for him to run as governor. And he just never forgave him. Although Lee Dreyfus did provide an excellent salary adjustment program. And in spite of everything else you do in education, financially, the most money comes in to the budget because of the salary adjustment program, and it gives us flexibility also from that, because you can get flexibility transfer in and out of there. That's where the dollars come, because, mm-hmm. I don't know, 80% of the budget is salaries. So if you add 7 or 8%, you get a lot of money in.
Yeah.
And through staff turnover and so forth, it does give you more flexibility. And Lee Dreyfus did a good job. You've heard it before, I know, because people you talk to will say the same thing I am. I don't think we had the same effective leadership after merger that we had when McPhee and Harrington were running the system.
Hmm.
This combined with the drop-off of the non-resident tuition, the drop-off enrollments due to increasing non-resident fees, really created a different kind of a situation. It really wasn't comparable. But the leadership in after merger was not effective as it was before. And I know you've heard that.
Well, I'm not actually stated like that. That's an interesting comment.
Yes.
I guess I guess what I would have heard is that because of merger, there couldn't be that kind of leadership again.
Well, now, wait a minute. Weaver was appointed prior to merger.
Uh-huh.
And under Harrington, he had two outstanding people relating in the legislative process. One was George Field, who became chancellor in River Falls, and the other is Wally Lemon. Both of them were very instrumental in developing what I would say strong budget and strong budget support for the University of Wisconsin-Madison. George Field left, and then of course he left towards the end, I believe, of Harrington's term. And then Weaver came in, and Weaver was not as effective. And he didn't surround him with people that were as effective. I don't believe that Don Percy, who was very intelligent and very articulate, could write, really had the kind of respect that you need for relating to legislators. He was a very combative individual who, who felt he had skills, but yet I don't think he came across well with the legislative, in the legislative process. And Ed Young was appointed, and Ed Young came in right after the regents had made it kind of difficult for Lee Dreyfus, and Ed was the one that had to convey the messages. And I can remember walking through the Capitol and meeting Lee Governor Dreyfus in the rotunda down below, and all I can remember is, I'm going to get those sons of bitches. And they came in right away with an ace.
He's talking about the regents.
I'm talking about Ed Young and Don Smith, who were the president, the executive vice president of the system. He couldn't do anything with the regents other than replace them.
That's too good. I want to make sure I'm clear about it. Lee Dreyfus said, who were sons of bitches?
I hope you're not going to quote this. Ed Young and Don Smith.
So they were. Dreyfus said that about Young and Smith, did he?
Yes, both of them. And in fact, neither one of them could go downtown. The only people that could relate to the downtown during those initial periods was the president of the board and myself. Nobody else was really welcome down there. For a short period of time. Until they replaced Ed Young. See, Ed Young only served a very short period of time, only 2 years.
Why was Dreyfus so opposed to him?
Well, because of this problem, and if you go back to one of the regent meeting in Parkside, and then what came out of that, where you sometime look back into the meeting which took place at Parkside. And then it wasn't very long after that Lee came in when he was elected. I think it was the December meeting, and they didn't recognize him for a long time in the meeting. And they finally introduced him. Everybody says, how can they even stand there and not recognize a governor-elect? They really didn't treat him with much respect.
Do you remember which meeting it was?
It was the Parkside meeting. The Parkside. It was the December meeting, as I recall it.
Of what year?
Of 80, of 70, I believe it was the December meeting of 70. I believe. I don't think they met in January of 79. I think it was December meeting of 78, and then they were slow to recognize it.
Okay.
I'm going to have to go then.
Oh, all right.